and we are back. Thank you so much for joining us. And this is another edition of our new series called Deep Dive. Very ingenuitive, very, very creative name, right? But again, we're doing this series because we've had several requests from listeners really over the last 6 months to a year, you know, that appreciate the way that we have focused. The aim of this show from the very beginning was to take complex investing, you know, situations, scenarios, topics, and break them down so you don't have to be a chartered financial analyst to understand what's going on. And I know that my two guests that are on with me today share the same sentiment. A lot of times in the financial worlds, we have unneeded complexity, and I think it's a little bit gratuitous and self-indulgent. And so we've tried to kind of pull that out of it and make it more of a layman's conversation so it's accessible to everybody, so people that don't do this for a living can understand what's going on. However, that kind of handcuffs you sometimes. And this deep dive segment may not be, you know, if you're a retail guy out there and you're listening, thank you. But this might be a little more dense, a little bit tougher to chew through. And so just give you that caveat, because we're really not going to try to interpret anything. Just going to let it roll. And the idea for this show was I've got on my two guests who are my go-to guys. One of them manages one of the portfolios that we offer. The other one is our go-to macro analyst that works with us on a daily and monthly basis. And the reason they're both here is they're the two guys whose opinions I value most. And the reason I value them most is because they've produced results over and over and over again. So I wanted to let the listeners in behind the scenes to a strategy session. We were going to have this conversation anyway, due to what's transpired, you know, over the last year or two and where we see markets going. And so we thought, you know what, let's record it. Let's see where it goes. So you guys can be inside of a, you know, we're not a multi-billion dollar hedge fund, but we manage $350 million. And you guys can be inside that process and kind of see how we put everything together. So without further ado, my two guests today, Mr. Marcos Bueno, who runs our algorithmic momentum portfolio. Marcos, thanks for joining us.
Thanks to you, Zach. Always a pleasure.
Well, not always, right? Hopefully, sometimes. Sometimes.
Always. Always, so far.
Yeah, you're too kind. See, that's that Spanish upbringing. You're just too polite. and then Chase Taylor of Pinecone Macro Research. Chase, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, always great to be on, and it's really fun to be on with Marcos as well. He's a lot smarter than me, so I think I'm going to learn some stuff today, too.
Well,
now you're setting expectations high.
Well, I'm going to comfort you both and say that the short straw in this conversation is the one leading it. So I will yield to both of you in that category. But see, that's also kind of my superpower, right? Is finding smarter people and getting them to work with me. So I'm, yeah, right, man. That's right. You don't have to come up with the idea. You just got to get to it, right? Anyway, so Chase, let's start with you on this one. And again, this is a conversation I want to have anyway. Look, everybody is playing the inflation deflation game. And if I'm being entirely honest to you, when I sit back and look at the data set out there right now on an economic level, I'm really torn in two. Part of me is sitting there going, look, I think this inflationary burst will not be transitory, assuming the pump continues. Because I think, and you know, let me know where I'm wrong, man. That's where the value is, as always. But I think that the Fed is sort of right and sort of wrong. That's kind of my read right now, meaning that I think if they stop doing these extraordinary liquidity pumps and things like that, I think it looks to me like the inflation would be pretty transitory in the next 6 to 8 months. I also can't see them actually doing that. Because I think it would be, you know, everybody's talking about tapering right now. I think under the construct, first of all, I want to be really clear that I think it's insane. And I think we can all agree. I think that the fact that we're here is insane. But looking at the construct, the current setup, I think it would be a policy mistake if they started tapering too soon. It would surprise me. I see these calls for tapering in September. That would shock me. I guess it wouldn't shock me. Nothing would shock me. But I look at the debt loads out there. I look at all this stuff. I just think that it would be kind of transitory unless they keep pumping. Would you agree with that, Chase? Or do you think the inflation genie is officially out of the bottle? How are we reading that? Because, and you can feel free to disagree. I look at this market, and to me, it really comes down to, and again, this isn't an original thought. It comes down to inflation versus deflation to me. And I think that's going to be the key winner, or the key getting that right is going to be to get it right or wrong over the next several years. Walk us through that.
Yeah, I think that's definitely correct. And it's going to be asset allocation is really going to come down to inflation, I think, moving forward. I think we are in sort of the first inning of getting secular inflation, but there's going to be cyclical, you know, up and down swings within that are going to happen. Even if we are bottoming, there's going to be times where it rolls over. And from a rate of change basis, a lot of the inflation is starting to roll over. Like the crazy used car stats are going to start coming off and maybe even becoming a headwind, things like that. So you're going to see growth fade a little. You're going to see inflation fade a little, but the same as everything right now, after you have kind of one of the worst falls in growth and then best rebounds in growth in history, back-to-back years, everything is difficult to kind of smooth out and make sense of right now. You have people that are focused on nothing but, you know, the levels of the data, and then you have people who have made a living on looking at nothing but rate of change of data, and you both kind of have wildly different arguments right now. And I think, sort of like you said, the Fed's kind of right and wrong. I think both people that look at just rate of change, you know, where are we at versus last year, and the people that just look at the pure levels are, or maybe where we are today versus the 5 or 10 year average, both of those people can make a decent case, and they're both kind of right and wrong. So it's going to be very interesting. And to me, what inflation really comes down to is just going to be government policy. If we have a sustained, you know, kind of demand side policy where we're stimulating demand, then we're going to keep getting inflation, and we're going to keep getting a hot economy and above trend growth. Really, in my opinion, almost no matter what the Fed does. So a lot of that's going to come down to politics. We're going to keep getting fiscal coming out of DC, but I don't think it's going to be quite as huge as a lot of people seem to expect. Even today, you kind of see some news coming out that some of the moderate Democrats may be able to get infrastructure through Congress without having attached it to the $3.5 trillion that will probably be less than $3.5 trillion when it's all over with. So it's kind of a DC watching game for now. When it comes to the Fed, something I find interesting is the Fed's obsession with always wanting to taper before raising interest rates. To me, given the constraints they're under, that makes no sense. They should just keep doing. Now, I think they should stop buying mortgage-backed securities, but to me, it's obvious they have to keep buying treasuries long-term, so they may as well just keep buying those, but then raise interest rates. I think at some point, they'll decouple that, and they'll stop viewing it that way, but it's pretty clear for the next, you know, year or whatever, they are going to try to taper before they try and raise rates. I don't think that's going to go great for them, probably. Partially because their timing is bad. They're gonna wait until the economy naturally starts to slow down, and they're gonna wait until after, you know, Treasury runs down the whole TGA, which was a huge head or tailwind for bonds. So you lose a giant tailwind, but basically the two biggest tailwinds you have for bonds, you lose those, and that's when you decide to go ahead and add some supply. That's probably not gonna go great.
Yeah. It just seems like that rate thing, you know, it seems like it could be a coiled spring. I mean, I just, my thought going forward on the macro level has been that I think that the Fed will do exactly what you just laid out, just looking at, you know, looking at what they've done in the past, which is, and again, I think it's insane that we're here. I don't think, you know, I disagree with the vast majority of Fed policy over the last 20 years. So, and the reason why I disagree with it is because I thought that it would lead to this place. I thought it would lead to a place where they couldn't get out. I thought it would lead to a place where they dominated public markets. I thought it would lead to a place where they had to continue, that if they persisted long enough, the crisis would be them stopping. Right. So the very crisis that they looked to avoid all these years, they're now the epicenter, right? If, in my opinion, if they normalized, and I don't mean undo it, right? Run down the balance sheet. I just mean if they normalized policy. I mean, I could be wrong. I just think the whole thing would come apart. And kind of the way that I've looked at it is that I kind of think they will do what you just said. And I think that we'll get a deflationary pressure again. And then they'll come running to the rescue again. And it just seems to me like we'll play that game until we officially go, you know, maybe pass a universal basic income, or, you know, where we go full ballistic mode. Because like I said, I just, you look at all the debt out there, and it's just hard for me to see without that Fed assistance, right, that you're not going to get a natural slowing. Now, something else you talked about, and this is kind of me taking a curve here. On the mortgage-backed security purchases, I got in a back and forth with a guy that happens to be the head of fixed income trading for Janney. And not a very pleasant back and forth. The guy thinks extraordinarily highly of his own abilities. I enjoy bumping into those guys, because whenever I see guys that are that confident, that know everything, it always makes me suspect of their ability. You know, I don't mean to, you know, I'm not going to say his name, and I don't mean to denigrate the guy, but I just think to be good in this business, I think you need to have a certain amount of humility, right? Nobody knows it all. Anyway, I digress. But I've always looked at the Fed purchasing mortgage-backed securities as an effort to lower mortgage rates. He was making the argument that the Fed could purchase as many mortgage-backed securities as they want, and it has zero impact on mortgage rates. Are you familiar at all with the actual mechanism determining mortgage rates, Chase?
I think that position is somewhat right, but it's not fully right. For one thing, if it didn't help, they wouldn't do it. But,
right, right.
I would say it is impacted more by just, you know, your basic, what the economy is doing, what policy rates are, what treasury yields are. Like that's going to impact it more than, you know, the Fed putting their thumb on mortgage-backed securities. But at the same time, I mean, at the end of the day, mortgages, what they're really about is government support. So whether it's necessarily just buying mortgage-backed securities or not, at the end of the day, it is almost a fully nationalized mortgage system in the U.S. So whether it's the Fed or the government themselves, with, you know, different guarantees and subsidies, they more or less run the mortgage market. If people were out there lending full-blown, you know, just on their own, when it came to risk, everything would be different when it came to mortgage rates. So mortgage rates obviously being tied to bond yields, it kind of makes sense, and it also kind of doesn't. It has nothing to do with the credit worthiness of the person buying the house. It has to do with, you know, the policy stance of the Fed, and those are two completely separate inputs. So I know I just made that a lot bigger than the question you asked, but I think he has a point, but overall, I think it does move the market, and I think just writ large, the government has their thumb on the scale of lending for real estate on such a massive scale that it kind of makes it a moot point.
Well, and the whole argument cracked me up, because his statement was that the reason that they bought $1 trillion worth of mortgage-backed securities was to give the banks more flexibility on their balance sheet. And I go, hold on a second. You can't have it both ways, man. You were just making the argument that the banks, even despite the downturn, that the banks are better capitalized than they've ever been in 25 years. So if that's the case, then the only reason the Fed's buying MBS is to push down their mortgage rates. Right? I mean, is there a flaw in that deductive reasoning?
I mean, no. not to me.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, Marco. Yeah. That was just a And Marcos, feel free to chime in on this too. But
yeah, I don't know what your friend said.
Friend is probably too strong a word.
but it definitely has an impact. Obviously, look, when you say what determines the price of the mortgages, from a bank's perspective, is what is the spread they can get versus their funding. Mm-hmm. So the funding comes from treasuries or whatever, or their balance sheet, how much they can get from the market, and then they lend it out, and what's the spread.
Yeah.
So obviously that's affected by the amount of credit they can shift out to some other people, right? When they do a mortgage-backed securities, they don't hold the risk anymore. The person that buys the securities holds the risk, the credit risk. So to the extent that the government is there buying those things and they're less sensitive to the credit risk of the borrower, so then that's going to push the price of the securities up, and that means that the yield is lower. So they're going to be able to offer cheaper mortgages to the public. So obviously it has an impact. If it was only private hands looking at buying these MBS, I can tell you the price will be different.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
And then the banks will say, okay, maybe we cannot sell these at this higher price, and it has to be a lower price, so we need to charge more interest rate to our clients because we cannot unload them as easily, because the people that are buying these mortgages are going to start looking at the collateral and credit worthiness and so forth, and where the Fed comes in and buys without looking at the price, then obviously that's going to send the price higher, not lower.
Right, right.
I mean, one of my friends, an actual friend, who is gone, but he used to run the credit trading desk as one of the New York banks. He got a new job now, but he said, we love it when the Fed comes in buying bonds because we know we can show them any price and they'll buy it. And they're not giving them the best price. So,
No way.
So they're happy when it comes in because it's a completely price insensitive. And when you have a buyer that is in price insensitive, they're not going to get the best deal. That means that the thing is overpriced, and that means that the yields are lower than they would otherwise be. I mean,
yeah, obviously. Yeah. Well, and I think that this, I mean, everybody's familiar with what's happened with real estate, especially in the last, 16 months. But I look at the real estate market right now, talking to clients, talking to people, and again, I could be wrong, but just sticking my head out the window going, I don't think that there is any way. It reminds me of going back to 2018, guys, where remember in the fourth quarter, a couple things happened, right? You had the big drawdown right before Christmas. And that was kind of the Jay Powell, looking back on it, kind of amusing. He's going to come in here and play the heavy hand, right, and put things back together. And the market took that stick out of his hand in about a month. And then the other thing that was interesting is, remember, there was a data point where new home sales in 2018 dropped 19%. And everybody's, what's wrong with the housing market? Well, the 30-year went from 3.3 to 5.1, and the housing market just stalled. Right, just stalled. New home sales down 19%. If you look at the rise in prices since then, I don't think there's any way you sustain this and keep those prices moving even laterally without the Fed continuing to push rates down. I mean, when you look at the median home price compared to back to 2007, we're 25-30% above it, something like that. The only thing that's keeping it in there is that the mortgage rates are 1/3 of what they were back then. I think if you pull back on rates here, you're going to see the house market just completely undo what it just did. Chase, what are your thoughts on that first, and then have Marcos chime in?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's really just a big rates game. Obviously, supply and demand plays a role, and that's had a big part in this, pandemic blast off where we have house prices kind of going up at the highest clip ever because there's not a lot of supply. But mm-hmm. at the end of the day, yeah, I mean, when we buy a house, we're all just buying a payment, not buying a purchase price. No one cares what that number is. It's just, what can I do per month? So yeah, if rates are going to move higher and they bring mortgage rates with them, that's going to be a problem, especially since you had a lot of building in the pipeline. Obviously, a lot of that's slowed down just because of materials. But you look at a lot of the new builds, people, they're booked for the next 2 years. A lot of construction work is in general, so. You'd be slowing down the market and kind of taking consumers away right at the same time as you just built kind of a big backlog of buildings. So you'd probably overbuild at the worst time, and that should obviously lead to a decent correction and at least take all the heat away from the housing market.
Mm. Hey, Marcos, A, what are your thoughts on that? And B, and I don't know if you're tapped into this, but what are, I have no clue what mortgage rates are in Spain or in Europe in general, by and large. I know that we had, I had Andreas Steno Larsson on the show a while back, and he's the global, what are, he's the, chief global strategist for Nordea, that Swedish bank. And he was telling me he bought a place in downtown Copenhagen, a condominium, and he had a negative 0.35 mortgage rate. Is that exclusive to Copenhagen, or is that kind of writ large across Europe? I haven't checked international mortgage rates.
I'm not a mortgage expert, but I tell you that I would buy a house if they would pay me to buy it.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
So for sure. If rates are go higher, obviously real estate is going to be affected, because just like Chase say, people just buy a payment, right?
Right.
We all do that. And I can tell you that in the same way, if they pay me to buy a house, probably I wouldn't care what the price is, right?
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you from a personal experience, mortgage rates in Europe are very low, actually. My wife and I were looking into buying a property in France for holidays because the mortgage rates are ridiculously low, given the inflation and the dynamic, and because of the ECB is keeping the rates so low. And in Sweden, the Riksbank is doing the same. So Germany, bonds are like all the way out negative rates, which is a complete aberration because of the central bank is forcing people to do that alongside laws that say that the banks have preferential treatment for buying government bonds. So basically it's a financial repression where people are basically repressed into buying these bonds and keeping the rates so low. So the result is that you get these weird things where you take on a loan and they pay you to take the loan, which is odd. I mean, it's complete nonsense. But that's the reality we live in. And so what that means is that people like Andreas and myself and others and saying, okay, buying this house is really cheap, so I'm going to do that. And what happens? Well, the house prices go up, and then the central banks get in this trap in which they did something that was an aberration, and that they cannot get out of it, as you sort of like were saying, Zach. Like, so, to answer your question, in Europe, I don't know, in Spain, I haven't looked, but I know that in France, we could get a mortgage, a 30-year mortgage at 1%.
Wow.
Right? 1%, you can rent it out, the house, you can use it, it's like, and then inflation is running at 2-3%, whatever. Like, if you want to have a store of value that doesn't have you cost you very much to carry, and then you can enjoy or you even get positive carry out of it via rents, obviously you're going to do it. So I think they are way too low. And that basically links to the bigger point that I think I want to make, is that central banks, the Fed, the ECB, the BOJ, all the big banks, what they want to do is keep real rates very low or negative. Because at the end of the day, there is too much debt, and we need to monetize that debt. We need to devalue the currency. We need to make real rates lower so the debt sort of like disappears, because there is only three ways of getting rid of debt. One is not pay it. And actually, two is just monetize the debt, so devalue the currency, so the relative value goes lower. Now, the problem is that the governments that issue the debt, they also like the cheap debt, so they keep issuing. So you have this race, like we try to monetize the debt, but the governments and corporates, they keep issuing it because, or people like me will continue to take it, or Andreas, because take on debt because it's so cheap. So basically, you get this treadmill that is very hard to get out, where you try to monetize the debt and there is more and more of it, and then rates have to be lower and lower, and it accelerates at some point.
Yeah, you kind of front run my next question, which that's because you're just always on point, pal. But that was going to be the next thing that I was going to get to, which is when you talk about 1% in Europe. And I see negative 0.35, and I would assume Japanese mortgages are somewhere between the two, and maybe that's a bad assumption. Again, I don't watch international mortgage markets, But you said something there, Marcos, that I could not agree with more, which is you get stuck there. And one of the things I've been looking at with the rate market is I just think it's inevitable to where we see 30-year money here in the U.S. at 1% or lower. And the reason I think it's inevitable is I am unaware of any economy or any country that has pursued 0% interest rate policy that has all of a sudden seen it reverse and had to start ratcheting up rates. I haven't seen that happen yet. And so when I see Denmark at -3 and I see, you know, France at 1 and all the different things that we're talking about, am I wrong to think that that's just inevitable? That's where we're going? I hate to use the word inevitable in investing because nothing really, you know, that's a word that can cost you a lot of money. Right? There's a difference between inevitability and imminence, right? So obviously want to be careful with that. But I look at it and why would we not hit 1%? Why would we not go lower? It's too easy of a pot, right? We've been doing it for years now. It's just, it's too easy of a lever to pull. It's too easy of a button to push. Do you think that that's inevitable? And then also for both of you, am I wrong in asserting that there really is no other game, that no other country has gotten that sustainable burst of inflation following these policies, and that we're just going to inevitably end up there?
Yeah. Look, my what I said makes things really simple in some ways and also very complicated, because the complicated thing is that we know more or less what's the dynamic. What is really, really hard is to actually trade it, because you can, under this scenario, what you would say, okay, we're going to short the bonds, right? Because if real interest rates are too low, the bonds will sell off to reflect that. The problem is that the bond market is sort of like a manipulated market. We see that in Europe to some extent in the US, though less, where the central bank is really manipulating, maybe a strong word, but basically disturbing the bond market. It's not a free market anymore. There's financial repression. People cannot get out of it. They are being forced to buy those bonds and keep the price high. And if they don't do that, then the central bank will come at the back and buy them. So you have these very strong forces. On the one hand, you don't want to own them. On the other hand, there's a big buyer, or you're being forced to buy them. So that makes it very difficult to trade. On the other hand, the easy part is like, okay, I don't need to buy them, so I don't buy them. And you can see that in places like Japan, where sometimes the government bond market does not trade at all. Like, people are not interested. That's sort of happening in other places, slowly. The U.S. is different because it still has positive interest rates by the government, and still the biggest bond market in the world, and the reserve currency. So it's slightly different, but the dynamic is the same. If prices are too high, people are not going to buy them. So the market dries out, but prices are too high artificially. Now, the easy part is that ultimately one should be buying income producing assets that are inflation linked, because I think that you still have some positive real interest rate, and that's one of the things that is driving real estate, and I think that will continue. On the one hand, you have rents that are linked to inflation, so that will continue. And then on the other hand, you sort of like getting subsidized on your debt. So that makes sense, and I think that will continue. Where this stops, I think, is when that inflation, when those prices keep going higher, and we sort of like, as Chase was saying, we're early innings of that, accelerates, and then the public says, stop this. Right now, everything's cool. We have had 10 years of very strong QE. Velocity of money has been going down, and inflation hasn't really been seen in a serious way, but I think ultimately it will be. And there will be a time where inflation is in the 8, 10, 12%, 15%, and people will say, stop this, that's enough. And that will be a crisis where governments will have to raise interest rates, stop QE, and basically public opinion will turn against them. Because right now, everything's nice, right? Everybody's making money, debt is cheap, we start to see early inflation and people starting to feel it, but still haven't really woken up to the fact that this is sort of like more permanent than it looks, and it's actually bad and it's accelerating. That's how I think it's going to go in the end. And that's the only way that will stop governments and central banks is public opinion raising against the fact that purchasing power is declining rapidly and they can feel it. And we're in the beginning of that process, I think.
Well, yeah, that was that's something clear. I put a tweet out the other day where I just said, you look around at what's going on with prices, whether it's food, fuel, whatever. Those stimulus checks are gone, right? The inflation has already swallowed that, in my opinion. And I think you're right. I think that it's interesting because I haven't heard it for so long and haven't seen it. But you're hearing people whimper, you know, the pinch of inflation, and it's interesting to hear that, to hear those clamorings, because I just don't think it's a matter of time till, I think it's just a matter of time until that scenario you're talking about plays out, where people start realizing, wait a second, you've given us the stimulus, but everything we buy has gone up by more than that, right? Chase, do you want to jump in here?
I don't have anything to add on that specifically.
Okay, well, there you go.
But as you said, Zach, I think the house is starting to creak a little bit. Right? It's like starting
right.
to. There is an undercurrent of unhappiness about this. Still very mild, but I think it will accelerate.
Consumer confidence will see just tumbled this morning, and for example, it's clear that obviously a big part of that is people starting to freak out about the Delta variant. But I think another big piece of that is people starting to feel inflation. So as a consumer, that's not good.
So let's flip it over a little bit to markets now. And Marcos, I'll have you lead us off there. I was thinking back to a show last October where we were talking about how we thought value was going to be the play going forward for 2021. And I said that I didn't think it was going to be an easy move. And I think the word that I used was it was going to be a knife fight, meaning I think there's so much muscle memory in if you see Tesla down 4 days in a row, just buy it because of that. You don't even pay attention to the price, using them as a whipping boy. But, if tech gets hit for whatever reason, you just buy it, right? That muscle memory has been so ingrained. And then we saw the earnings opportunities on the value side, on the natural resource side, still very much do. But it has been a knife fight. It's been a knife. It's one of those things where you laugh at and you're like, I wish I wouldn't have been as right as I was, and not extolling my own. But just sitting there watching this, it's like day in, day out. Russell 2000 up, NASDAQ flat or negative. Flip it around the next day, NASDAQ up, Russell 2000 down, flat or negative. And I know Russell 2000 isn't a value index, right? There's a lot more value companies into it because they've fallen down the pecking order, right? Nobody wants to buy them by at least by their market cap weighting. But looking at that and just saying, some of the prices you see out there are just when you look at the growth rate of some of these value companies, it's kind of an overused term. I don't really like it, but I'm seeing some of the things all of a sudden. Since last October, it was like the value these things represented and the tidiness of their balance sheet and their cash flows. All of a sudden, it seemed like we had like a 6 month period of time where that stuff mattered again. Right. And then for the last 3 or 4 months, it hasn't. And it's just been this back and forth washout. So what are you seeing on the momentum side, Marcos? When you look at these indexes, what are you seeing? What does it look like to you? Do you see that knife fight? Do you see any side of it winning right now? Or is it just a dead heat? How are you viewing this?
So far, it's been a pretty even fight. I think this year has been extremely complicated in terms of constant rotations between back and forth between inflation, deflation, and bonds up, bonds down. And that has been percolating to the equity market. Like, as you were saying, NASDAQ up, Russell down, Russell up, NASDAQ down almost on a daily basis, basically mostly driven by macro flows. I think it's been very difficult on the stock picking side and on the macro side because of the macro side has been very difficult to read. And then on the stock picking side, everything has been driven by macro that in itself has been difficult. So I think this year has been particularly complicated. And we saw we also see some of the big macro hedge funds that have been very successful in the past years struggling this year. And I think that also is indicative of how difficult it has been. On more particularly on the equity market, on the momentum side, this has been also a fight. Like, we will get 3-4 weeks of one sector getting some impulse and enthusiasm and then dying, and then the other side, more value-oriented, will rally, and then another 3 weeks, and then 3 weeks down, and they will, like, compete and back and forth with actually going nowhere or almost nowhere. So that's complicated. In the last 2 months or so, what I have seen is that even though the indices were still going up, a lot of the individual names were not going up. Mm-hmm. And people, because of this difficulty, people have been seeking refuge in the super mega caps like Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Google, Facebook, where a lot of the money has gone in there. So those are the biggest weightings in the index. And those names have been going well because they have getting inflows. So that was supporting the indices. But underlying that, the majority of the names were not going up. They were going down. So this sort of like breadth of the market was pretty bad. Even the indices were going up. Most stocks were not going up. They were going down. And actually the algo at some point was at all-time highs at the market was 80% invested because it didn't find enough good opportunities. It didn't find enough names that it liked that were going up because so few of them were going up. So it became very conservative. That helped at some point where the market sold off and the algo outperformed. In the last month or so, it seems to me, though the last 2 weeks sort of like give me some caution, but 2 weeks ago I was thinking, okay, this has changed now. We're latching onto some good trends. They were mostly on the consumer discretionary side or like, and some of them on the discount side and credit side. It was things like Domino's, things like Chipotle, Nike. We see things like Dealers. We see things like very consumer related. They have pricing power. The consumer are buying some things with the stimulus checks, and those are benefiting the rest. Technology doesn't have a trend. Energy doesn't have a trend. Financials are struggling. They're pretty high, but they don't really have a definite trend. There's just not a lot of uptrends out there outside of that. And I thought that we're going to be latching onto something special there. In the last 2 weeks, things have slowed down again, and we go back to the dynamic of only a handful of names are going up, where people are trying to, seek refuge because they don't really have a lot of idea what to do here. And this is in a context in which equity flows this year into the equity market has been gigantic, gigantic. So there's this statistic from Merrill Lynch that in the first half of the year, annualized, it was bigger than the previous 20 years. So basically, branding numbers, in the first half of the year, we had as many inflows into equity market as we had in the last 10 years, which is incredible.
That's insane.
And yet, most stocks were going down.
How is that possible?
How is that possible, right? It's like the most of the money were going to the big names. That's why they get more and more weight in the indices, and that's why the indices are somewhat supported. But the dynamic underlying is not very positive. So that is concerning.
It seems to me, Marcos, like the market feels soggy to me. It just feels like everybody who could be in is in.
Yes, it does. And it feels the same to me, and I see some breakouts that then falter. And they whittle. I see that many, many, many times this year. That is not a great sign. And my interpretation of this is that it's going to be a binary thing. If this inflows stop, we go down for sure.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a lot of natural demand for the market. I think people wanted to invest at these prices. Sort of like a bit like the bond market, right? If the Fed, the central banks stop buying bonds, they're going to go down for sure. Because there's not a lot of people that want to buy those bonds. Same thing with the stocks. I don't think there's a lot of people that want to buy the stocks. So there is a bit of an artificial demand with all these like billions, like 30, 40, 70 billion a month of assets. Some of them end up in the equity market. So that is not natural demand, I would call it. So now, if that stops, the market goes down. That's for sure. Now, the trick here is that maybe those flows do not stop. And then all these people that have been sort of like taking advantage of the high prices to sell and putting into other assets, whatever they are, if those selling pressures stop and only the inflows remain, we can get into parabolic move up. So I see this sort of like binary scenario where it can go either way. Like,
yeah, that really dovetails into a lot of Mike Green's work, exactly the way he looks at it.
Yeah, we're balancing those two forces, and I don't know who's going to win. It looks like the buying is winning. I think ultimately the buyers have infinite supply of money because the Fed can print as much as they want and the central banks can print as much as they want versus the selling side, which is limited. The sellers have limited ammunition to sell because there's only a certain amount that people can sell without while staying within their mandates. So I think the buying side will have the upper hand. But it's sort of like a tricky one. It's a tricky moment.
Well, and you guys both know, and Chase, I want to get your thoughts on this too, but you guys both know, I'm a value guy. And I'm talking my own book because I run our value fund. But yeah, I'll just tell you that I've been getting more cautious on that side too, not because of the underlying economic realities. I mean, some of these stocks that we've picked, their earnings have just been explosive. And that does not look transitory on several of the names that we own for a variety of different reasons. And I don't want to get into the individual names. But the one thing I started noticing, though, over the last month and a half to 2 months is the stocks quit responding to it. So you'd get an unbelievable earnings report, nothing, flat. You'd even see pullbacks in this stuff. And it gives me pause because it reminds me so much of the last 6 to 7 years, sitting there coming up with a thesis to buy a stock, watching the company execute flawlessly, numbers come out, and because it's not tech, nobody cares, right? Stock goes nowhere. I've started seeing that. Now, the thing I'm trying to wrap my head around is, I mean, it's kind of crazy, guys. We've got several names that we've purchased in the last year. That are your classic value plays, well operated, good margin, firing on all cylinders. And we're up in a lot of those names. But a lot of them, while we've owned them, the stock has moved up, but the PE ratio, right? The price, the valuation of the things has dropped in half, right? So we bought some of these names at 14, 15, 16 PEs. They're at 7 or 8 now because, they've gotten cheaper. And because their earnings, the bounce back in earnings has just been so intense. And yet the market is back to all of a sudden over the last 2 to 3 months. It just doesn't care. Chase, jump into this one. Give us your read on it and what you're seeing.
So just to go kind of all the way back to the knife fight in general, I think this year has been kind of interesting because to me, it started off really easy. If you were just long, like value, commodities, things like that, not only was it just going up, but it was going up almost every day and a little bit. It was like a really steady, low vol march higher. And
it made me feel like a tech investor, dude.
Yeah.
We were up 35% in the first quarter. I think we were up 50% since election day. It was just beautiful.
And naturally, so the Fed in June kind of is what broke that. And it didn't necessarily break any of these, in a real sense, but what it did was it increased a lot of vol. It made the ranges a lot bigger. So, it makes it harder to hold. It makes it harder to, as an investor, it's harder. As a trader, it can be great to kind of start playing the bounces around the ranges. The oil chart is a perfect example of this. I mean, it just go up a little every day. And lately, it takes some nasty dips and then it rips back and then another nasty dip. So there's a range there. And I think that's going to kind of be the case moving forward for all this stuff. Everything's harder now. I keep going back to this levels versus rate of change thing because to me it's really important. You could look at, say, retail sales and look at it on a rate of change basis for 6 months or a year, and it might start looking terrible. And then you look at it versus the last 10 years, and you're at a level you would have done anything to attain. 3 years ago from the post GFC until the fiscal, explosion of this last year, we had a really slow recovery. which in some ways is good for financial assets. But now all of a sudden we have really powerful, you know, growth, and we're starting to get this inflation. But on that growth side, like, that's nothing to sneeze at. You look at household balance sheets, they're phenomenal. You look at, you know, leverage ratios for a lot of companies and just regular folks. Like, all of a sudden people have exploding net worth, they have exploding excess income. So it makes it easy to see, like, from an economic standpoint, all that continuing to go well. And that makes it kind of easy to imagine yields, you know, continuing to grind higher. And to me, that's what it all comes back to. Like, if yields keep moving higher, then that's where you start getting value and small caps start doing well, and you start seeing maybe, you know, the tech stuff struggle. I think if inflation would have been a big surprise higher this last week, I think you would have seen NASDAQ sell off 2 or 3%. And I think that's going to continue to be the case, where that stuff can't handle significantly higher nominal yields, especially if they're moving up fast. And if we start seeing that back up, you know, in yields back towards, you know, 2%, then value starts doing great again, and small caps start to do a little better again. So really, it's just one big trade. It's just one big kind of yield trade and one big kind of dollar trade.
Yeah. So, and then getting into the specifics of it, guys, because this is one of the things that I wanted to ask you both. Because what I'm struggling with is, obviously, we've had a really good year in the value portfolio. We're bouncing around between up 35, up 40 on the year. And as a value manager, I have zero interest in getting that back, right? What a long, hard road it's been. And I'm stuck between two different things. I think that, Chase, you drilled it on the rate thing, at least from my perspective. I think that's a big deal. One of the things, and so here, let me lay out my question, my base question, and I'll kind of get into some subcomponents of it that I wanted to get out of both of you and get your takes on. But my big question is this the time? And I'm writing a client update letter that I hope to get out today that I've been working on for the last week, because I'm wrestling with this. Is this the time to be flexible and pivot out of the way and lean back into the tech and growth names if it starts rolling over that way? Or is this the time where, if we get a move that direction, that we dig in our heels and, you know, keep a long-term focus and start and continue to buy those value names on the dips? And I it's painful even letting those words escape my mouth, because I know what has happened if you've done that for the last, like I said, 7, 8, 9 years. And that's the thing that I'm wrestling with. Like I said, I don't want to give back this, what's been a great year already. I think that there's immense potential for it to that run to continue into year end and kind of a resurgence, and, you know, finish the year significantly even higher. Again, just based on the underlying fundamentals and the valuations of so many of these companies. And I think the thing that I'm wrestling with the most, and Chase, you alluded to it, is, and there's always an element of this in markets, it just seems to be larger now than ever before, which is, we talked about the inflation number coming in high. The inflation number is complete nonsense anyway. And especially CPI anyway. It just says whatever they want it to say. And I look at that, and you watch the market trading on this news, and markets are supposed to be all about price discovery. We react violently to these metrics that don't really matter, that economically don't really say anything. And it just seems like the market is so distorted. You look at the movements of these individual things, and again, I know markets do this from day to day, but we're so disconnected from reality. We've all come to expect, oh, well, if interest rates pop up a little bit, that means that this, and you go, okay, well, why are they popping up? Well, because we have a lighter inflation read. And you go, well, the inflation read's nonsense anyway. That's the other thing that makes this so hard, because you're sitting there going, is the market going to respond to reality, or is it going to be meme driven? And I think it's meme driven right now. And the tougher part about that is that meme driven or reality driven doesn't really matter. At the end of the day, people are still making and losing money. Right. So, there's a lot there, obviously, but that's the central thing I'm wrestling with, guys, is how we're going to run the fund for the rest of the year. And I feel torn between this thing of going, okay, do we pivot and protect and get out of the way? Or is this the time where we go, nope, we're bellied up to the bar. If you want to sell this stuff off, we think the time is now, and we will take 6 months of underperformance and we will risk giving a little bit back because we know what the long-term opportunity set is, and we're not going to let short-term moves distract us. That's the core question that I'm wrestling with.
Yeah, to me, that really comes down to like the fundamental backdrop. The no kidding, like what are the drivers changing? So, if the drivers aren't changing, if you're still convinced, you know, monetary policy stays accommodative, and Congress keeps spending, you know, kind of more money than we're used to, then you're gonna keep having inflation higher. You're gonna have bond yields wanting to move a little higher, and then that scenario, like you stayed belly up to the bar and you just let it work. And if you have to take a little bit of a drawdown in that environment, that's fine. And then on the flip side, you know, if the Fed kind of gets away from their average inflation targeting kind of new framework, and they get aggressive and they start trying to play catch up on, say inflation kind of keeps rising higher, and they get really aggressive and they start talking about rate hikes, you know, in the second quarter next year, you know, they bring it forward 3, 4, 5 quarters than what everyone expects within maybe a 3, 4 month window. If something like that happens, and you know, next year if the Republicans take the House and they're saying, you know, we're done spending money, things like that, then that's when you say, okay, well, that's now it's time to. You try to see those things coming a little bit so that you don't wait to take profits after everyone else did. But that's kind of the way I view it. Like if none of those big drivers change, then you allow this volatility to work for you, not against you, and you don't make a major change. And on the flip side, if it looks like those main drivers are going to change or are changing, then yeah, you get out of the way. You buy, you know, you go buy some treasuries and buy some, you know, whatever, some utilities or something. But for now, I wouldn't.
Or, I mean, you could just load up on, you know, the SPACs, right? I mean, we,
right? For me, it's really hard to do that. I would have to find a couple little idiosyncratic things that trade alongside tech that I just happen to also, you know, like and think maybe it has some runway. So like, you think about that, like, the stuff that's attached to that but maybe is, like, real. It's like a real asset that people need in order to feed those crazy growth tech, you know, names. So, you know, perfect example of that is, you know, something like lithium or aluminum or something that's going to feed into a lot of this stuff. Just off the top of my head.
Yeah, I want to switch over to Marcos, but you just brought up one of the things that amuses me again, and I just chalk it up to this is the market. You can cry about it, you can complain about it, but it is what it is. The enthusiasm around electric vehicles. Now, I know copper's had a good rally, right? But if electric vehicles and Chase, well, I want to hear Marcos's thing too, but and I don't want to switch the topic here. Get you both on the horn here, and I want to throw it all at you. There's another dislocation that I find humorous is that the EV space is right everybody's baby, and it's going to blow up, and then you look at copper and go, okay, well, guys, if that's the case, copper's got to go a lot higher, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And to go back to the previous question, you know, like that's kind of the beauty of Marcos and having the kind of trend overlay is, you know, if you are wrong and all that value stuff starts to go away and all the tech stuff starts to fly or whatever, then he's going to pick that up and he's going to have the right exposure. So,
oh brother, don't I know it?
Sometimes you don't want to be on the same page.
Hey, what Marcos?
No, the algo has been picking up some tech stuff lately.
Has it? I haven't been paying attention. What is it? What names has it grabbed?
So we have names like Snapchat. We have names like Dexcom, Datadog, AMD. Those are the last four names.
Wow.
That's the beauty of it. It'll buy stuff you would never buy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
A thing called Onto Innovation, which is about microchips and stuff. So he's picking up some of the microchip shortage names that benefit from it and some other things that have been coming up. He didn't have tech names for a few months, basically. Now he's picking them up again.
So would you say right now the allocation on the algo, is it like half-half?
No, it's still very consumer discretionary, but tech has gone up from at the end of July was around 11%. It had been down to 5%. It started to pick up. Now it must be around 18% or so.
And that's the funny thing that you and I have noticed about the algo is there have been so many times where you and I are having a conversation and then we look at the algo and we're like, oh, the algo is having the exact same, right? It's having the exact same issue. Trying to read where the knife fight's going to go. It's been hilarious to watch that play out. Marcos, what are your thoughts on the value side of it?
I have a slightly different view from Chase, and my advice will be to remain true to what you do, in the sense that, as you were sort of like alluding to, all these CPI numbers and how the market goes crazy around it, even though the number in itself doesn't mean very much, it's all about the Fed reaction function. We're all trying to guess what the Fed is going to do. And Chase was also talking about that. If the Fed does this, then do that. And if the Fed does that other thing, then do that other thing. The problem is that I don't think even the Fed knows what they want to do or what they can do. And this is a very difficult game. That's a very difficult game. I was like trying to guess what Jay Powell and his friends are going to do, and Congress, and there's so many factors that go into there. They may not be completely rational from our perspective. Obviously, they will be rational from their own perspective, but guessing how they're going to react, it's going to be very, very difficult, I think. I mean, and we see that in the market, because the market is very difficult because we're playing on that. My advice would be to stick to your knitting, and if you don't see opportunities, just don't. Take. Don't be forced. Don't swing at the pitches you don't like, basically.
Yeah.
Because there's no striking out in the game. Like, you can have 10 pitches you don't like and just wait for the good pitch. Who cares what the market does? Ultimately, who cares? What you want is to do the right thing with the portfolio. And given where you are, I will just wait until the opportunities come. And then when you see a good pitch, then you swing. And if you don't see a good pitch, then you don't.
Well, as simple as that. No, and Chase brings up a good point. That's why it is such a relief to have the algo backing you. You know, because last year was a perfect example. The portfolios together finished up, 20.2% or something like that for the year. But it was virtually, value didn't get hot until right after the election. And same in 2019, right? It was a rough year for value. That was tough. But thank God, the algo carries the day. And watching and then when the algo has struggled, Marcos, and I remember you and I talking about that and really hoping that this was the play, this is the way it would play out. But it hasn't struggled. It's doing good this year too. But, for the first time since we've launched it, I don't really remember a time where it's trailed the S&P, and that yet when it hits that bump in the road, the value portfolio is up 35% on the year, 36 or whatever it is now.
Yeah. Earlier in the year, it started really well and then started to flatline as value was sort of like the old winners were being sold, which is normally where the algo is. And then the new winners were appearing, that's where the value, and it takes the algo some time to pivot, right?
Yeah.
And that the algo started to flatline. I think it's been flatlining. It was flatlining for 3-4 months until it took another leg higher. So it's in line with the market right now. But yes, during that time where the value was ripping, right? So that's the beauty of it. And I would think that going forward, that's what I would advice. It's like you don't see things that you like, then don't. I mean, it's fine.
Yeah, I guess I'm just a lot of scar tissue. I look at so many of the names we own, and fundamentally, I feel so strongly about them, and yet that scar tissue from watching that happen, where and people that have listened to the show before have probably heard me talk about the whole PACCAR, and I use that just because it was a poster child of what I'm talking about. But we bought that stock at 58. Watched revenues increase by over 50% over the next 4 years. Margins improved. They upped their dividend, issued a special dividend, lowered their debt. I mean, just you couldn't ask for better performance. The only thing that happened to the stock, I think it went up to like 62, and the valuation got cut in half. And I just look at some of these names and I go, oh Lord, am I walking back into that buzzsaw again? You know, where it just no one, nobody cares. It's like a tree falling in the forest. We blew out earnings. Nobody cares.
Sometimes you can get a fat pitch and then the market moves the feet, you know, moves the fence back to 800 feet and it doesn't matter. So.
That's exactly what it feels like, you know, or you're just sitting there going, what? And like you said, Marcos, that's certainly where I'm leaning is, you know, keep into your knitting. Chase, flipping it over a little bit now on the commodity side, you've had some great calls. I don't think any were more prescient or timely than your call on coal. That was pretty ridiculous. Where do you see, how sensitive do you think commodity prices are going to be to the stuff that we're talking about? And what I mean by that is I'm not so much looking at the price, because we all know how insane this market is and the volatility and the way it's, we've already covered the way it's reacting to things that it shouldn't be, you know, all that other kind of stuff. My question is this, when you look at the setup here on a macro level, on a supply and demand basis, do you continue to see the demand for these types of commodities that we've been talking about that are represented in the portfolio? Do you think the demand for these commodities is going to continue to rise? And if so, you know, because there's a point at some place where supply starts coming back online. Where are you seeing on just kind of the supply? How are you looking at the supply and demand side of so many of these commodities that we're looking at right now?
Yeah, so I think demand stays, you know, just kind of steadily moving higher and stays solid. And really, most of the story is on the supply side. I think there are just kind of structural like impediments to adding significant supply to almost any fossil fuel, but also copper. Depending on, you know, which commodity you're talking about a multi-year, you know, lead time to even get a supply response. So you have to you'll kind of watch and see CapEx explode higher, and then you'll start seeing, you know, all that, you know, 2-3 years later, you'll start seeing some supply come back. And as of right now, you're just not seeing that. There's so much capital discipline in commodity markets at the moment. It won't last forever. I think some people, you know, kid themselves on that. But for now, it's just how it is. All these different markets have been so bad for the last 10, 20 years that investors want to get paid. So they're demanding to get paid right now. And anyone that sort of gets out of line and goes out and starts spending money to, you know, build a new mine or drill some new wells tend to get punished immediately by the market. And the folks that are out there saying, "Hey, we're going to buy back shares and give you a big dividend," they're getting, you know, rewarded. So your average CEO is going to see that and just do what the market wants. So for the immediate future, I don't expect significant spending. And when you look at oil, it's really going to have to come down to national oil companies. If OPEC has to really stand in and give all of their supply, and then they have to increase their capacity, because most of the non-OPEC world is just not going to be able to respond and add back enough supply, especially fast enough to get to where I personally see demand in, you know, what, 2 years from now. So, and then, you know, I just did the deep dive on copper, and if people are even half right about all the copper we're going to need for kind of, you know, this energy transition, then we not only do we not have enough copper, but we don't have enough copper by an order of magnitude. Some of the estimates for, you know, you're looking at it like 2030 for where demand will be because of electric vehicle adoption, things like that. You need to add multiple equivalents to the largest mine in the world, like 5, 6, 7 times over the biggest mine in the world in order to have enough copper. And in that same sort of math kind of matriculates through a lot of these different markets. Obviously, you look at coal. Outside of a place like China, and even in China, they're trying to restrict it. Good luck, you know, getting financing to build a coal mine almost anywhere in the world right now, especially in the West. And that same thing for oil. It's so hard to get the capital. It's so hard to get, you know, and your investors to green light the CapEx. So we sort of we're holding back supply on purpose. and we're doing nothing to limit demand. So you're just kind of naturally going to get higher prices when you do that until one of those snaps, until you just do get a giant wave of CapEx, or, you know, somebody does something to limit demand, or you have, you know, an aggressive global slowdown that limits demand. But I don't really see any of that in the next, 18 months. So to me, most of these commodities just keep marching higher in the next 18 months.
And that's one of the confusing part. Well, and like I said, it's not new, but that is one of the confusing aspects of this for me, is that you see so many of these scenarios and so many of these stocks where the fundamental underpinnings are so strong, and yet they can't catch a bid because investors would rather pay 30 or 40x revenue for a speculative tech play. And that's what that's kind of the genesis of what I'm wrestling with, because, you know, I look at these things and I think I've said it before, I think certainty is death in this business, but I'm about as close to certain at looking at a lot of these things and going, I know for a fact over the long run, these are going to be huge names. The question is how much short-term pain am I going to have to endure holding them? Mm-hmm. You know?
Absolutely.
And that's that wrestling with, you know, because let's face it, I don't even like to give a lot of oxygen to this because I don't want it morphing or distorting the way that I'm looking at things. But you know, the career risk aspect of this market is real, you know. Underperformance, it's a real threat. And it's, you know, and I think it's probably never been more of a threat than it is now, especially for a value manager. And again, I realize it's a lot of the scar tissue talking, but you know, just trying to wrap your head around that and saying, you know, I know, you know, you look at some of these, a lot of the ones that have popped up, guys, on my screen lately, especially like the oil services companies. There's some obviously that are in bad shape that aren't going to make it, you know, but in general, you can find some good ones, some well-capitalized. They're giving this stuff away. I mean, they're acting as if we're never going to drill a well in this country again. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Like I just wrote the piece about offshore and highlighted Valaris in there. Like they have net cash and it's, you know, it trades incredibly cheap. And a lot of the specifically the offshore kind of suppliers are, for the most part, most of them are around 50% of their, you know, of their rigs are deployed. So half of their rigs are costing them money and half of them are making them money. If they can get that ratio even reasonably higher and, you know, their day rates go higher, the re-rating on some of those names will just be just immense. And
yeah,
offshore is kind of the last, like, smart way to get oil for non-OPEC, but it's also going to be a big part of OPEC's, you know, production increases in the next decade. So the world kind of left offshore behind. And I think whenever we realize the quote unquote spare capacity that we think OPEC has right now, whenever that all comes back and shale, you know, largely comes back and we look around and we're like, oh, cool, like we still don't have enough oil. That's when what I referred to in the letter is a hungry, hungry hippos moment where everyone's trying to go get, you know, offshore rigs to put to work, and there's not going to be enough of them. Transocean, I think, they sold off like 60 rigs or something in the last like 5 years, just divesting. And there's this, and there obviously nobody's building new ones right now. That wouldn't make any sense. So that's why I kind of love these businesses. They're just incredibly cyclical, and in a way where you just overshoot and undershoot just tremendously on both sides of the cycle. But then usually you kind of get a heads up whenever that cycle's turning, and it's obviously not easy. You can ask anyone that's ever invested in some of this stuff. You know, like I think 4 or 5 big offshore names went bankrupt in 2020 because of what happened with the pandemic. So obviously it's very difficult place, you know, to play, but it's also where at the right time in cycles there's tremendous value.
Oh yeah, no, the SPAC and tech like returns, man, when you get it right. Marcos, again, I know the lens you look. Well, that's why I love getting your take, because at your core you're a value guy, and
And a commodity guy. I made macaroni in commodities.
Right. And this cycle, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this cycle has made you more, much more of a trend follower and momentum guy until this is over. Is that fair?
I just decided to simplify my life.
because you want to own stocks that are going up and you want to sell them when they quit, right?
Yeah. I made things simpler, and I basically realized that a lot of the fundamental work that we do is trying to predict the future supply and demand of stock, which is ultimately what sets the price. So I decided to just look at the supply and demand of stock without anything else, because that's what matters. So I decided to look at what matters instead of trying to guess. And being a lot more agnostic and less trying to be predictive. That said, as you said, I continue to be a value guy, and I have a long-term portfolio that is separate from the algo, which is a lot more tactical, because there are some things that if you have a long enough holding period, that can work. And I actually do have some energy names in it, because I agree with what Chase said. I think that the key here is the cost of capital for commodity producers is getting higher, right? That is good for the commodities for all the reasons that he said. The problem is that that's not necessarily good for the stocks. When stocks go up when their cost of capital moves from high to low, and they normally go down when this cost of capital goes from low to high. So now all these SPACs have a very low cost of capital. People wouldn't care about anything, which is get the money. This has changed. People are starting to be more restrictive with the capital. I think some of the tech names and venture capital, they have very low cost of capital. People don't care. They believe so that they're willing to accept lower returns for the money, so they put it in there. And I think the commodity space has been going through the opposite lately, where the cost of capital was very cheap when in the 2004 to 2008, and now with ESG and all that stuff getting higher. So as there's no money to build new mines or drink new oil fields and things like that. So, but that's not necessarily good for the stock, even though it's good for the commodity itself. So it's very hard to play unless we see prices that are so high on the commodity space that there's too much money there. And then the consequences of high commodity prices are being felt, and there is a change in sentiment that says we need to invest in commodities, and it's acceptable to invest in commodities, and that will make the cost of capital go lower and the stocks go higher. From a big picture perspective, that's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, very difficult to read, to forecast this, because it could be a couple of years before that happens.
Yeah.
It could be a long time. Like now oil is at 70. I happen to be a little bit and copper is around 425. I happen to be a little bit conservative or like concerned about those in the next 6 months or so. But ultimately, I think they're going to go higher, and there will be a point where we will reach that moment where it's enough is enough. We need to invest. It will be sort of like acceptable to do that. I think that price point is much higher this time than it was last time. So I think there's upside on commodity prices.
Yeah.
When it comes to stocks, it's much harder, right? Because if you're an oil company or a copper company and your only driver is the commodity price and you're not growing in terms of production, and then you have an asset that by its very nature is declining because everything you take out of the ground is something that you cannot take up again. So it's not recurring. It's not like a baker, right, that he sends a loaf of bread and the next day has another one to sell. No, this is not like this. When you sell a barrel of oil, it's one barrel of oil less that you have to sell. So unless you replace it, unless you invest to find more, you're not growing. Basically, your asset base is declining. Even though, and maybe the price of the commodity is going higher, but they most likely will cancel each other out, and people do not like businesses that are not growing. So basically, you're running on the spot with a declining asset. So that may not be good for the commodity producers or the service companies, mining services or oil services. And until the moment in time where the mentality changes. And that's very hard to protect. I think the best way to do that is just observe how market participants are going. And when it turns, basically the charts will tell you that when it starts trending up from a low base, you may not capture the absolute bottom, but you may actually get a much better price than you bought today or like you bought 2 years ago. And then you will have a much easier life riding the uptrend as opposed to try to catch a bottom. I think it is, unless you have sort of like this 5 to 5 year time horizon where you don't really care and your positions are small enough to not care, basically. You say, I'm willing to lose everything here. As a professional investor, that's really hard to do, right?
Yeah.
It's very hard to do with client money unless you have a specific mandate to do that or some sort of permanent capital. That's why value investing in public market is so difficult, right? Because even though you have a five year view, your investors may not have a 5 year time horizon. It's like, okay, what did you do for me last month? That's sort of like the mentality. So that makes things really hard.
So let me run this by you guys, because this is, especially after this talk, I think that this is kind of the way that I'm leaning. One of the things that we've been doing in the value portfolio is holding a core of, you know, as far as evaluation goes, finding the cheapest, best growing tech names, or it not necessarily have to be tech, but more on the growth side, trying to find the ones that are giving you the good numbers that everybody in the market's looking for, at the same time have valuations that are preferably cheap, but that certainly makes sense, and using that as almost a buffer, and then, you know, kind of harvesting profits off that to keep buying some of these value and commodity stuff, things on the dips, and that's really helped out because A, it's lowered the volatility of the portfolio. B, it's kept us from moving backwards hard. You know, when you get these rotations and stuff, that's the approach that I'm leaning to, just sticking with right now until we have more clear sign. And at some point, I view those tech and growth names that we do own in the value portfolio as dry powder to purchase more of the stuff that we really like that really fits that value mold. What do you guys? We'll start with Chase. What do you think about kind of maintaining that posture through the end of the year, and do you think that's a good idea?
Yeah, and I think so. What we were just talking about, you know, with like energy stock kind of not keeping up with oil, I think it's something that's like on a lot of people's mind. And I just always come back to this. I feel like people are missing it, but the NASDAQ is up about 17% year to date, and the oil and gas ETF is up about 42%. So,
right,
like, I mean, you are getting, you know, some return there. And going back to what Marcos was saying about cost of capital, that's true, and that's always true. But if you look at just the free cash flow you're getting for a lot of the oil and gas names out there, they could buy back their entire enterprise value in like 5-ish years. So I how much capital do I need if my free cash flow, like, I don't even know what to do with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think there are some, and now there are some names that absolutely need capital, and especially when it comes time to expand production. And to Marcos's point, like, if you're not doing that, if you're not finding new resources and developing them, then you're dying. But I think we're so used to growth getting all the benefit of the doubt because yields are, you know, pinned at nothing. So that again goes back to if yields are going to start moving higher over time, then I think your average investor kind of has to think less about like just chasing growth. And in an inflationary world, if we do actually get secular inflation, it kind of becomes nice to have people that have a bunch of clunky assets laying around, whether that's, you know, a bunch of oil in the ground or steel parked in a port or whatever. That all of a sudden kind of it goes from being a giant liability to being sort of an asset, you know, that you have that sitting around. So to me, that's kind of why that the value starts doing well when yields move higher and vice versa. So I think keeping in mind that the fact that cash flow for a lot of these commodity producers is just insane right now, that's important to keep in mind. And about the time that changes will be when they go all in on CapEx, and that's when you want to start trimming. And that'll be about the same time that the rest of the market and CNBC all of a sudden thinks oil and gas and coal and all these things are the best things since sliced bread, and the stocks are going to be flying higher.
That will happen. That will happen.
Yeah, and that's
last,
when the CapEx explosion happens, and that's when you get out.
It happened last year, and I don't mean to pick on him, but I just heard over and over Jim Cramer in the middle of last year, and like, you can't touch oil, you can't touch oil. I heard an excerpt the other day. Now, these things have rallied 150, 200% off the bottom, a lot of them. All right, now here are the oil plays, right? You're sitting there going, what? Wait, now? No, I'm waiting for that too. And the reason I don't want to miss that is something that we all know, is by the time they say it on CNBC, all the easy money's been made, right? You know,
yeah,
and that,
there are cycles. That was the first quarter. Now you get a break. And then it will have another wave, and then we'll another break, and then another wave.
Yeah.
But we're not near any exuberance in those names. And another thing Chase made a point, sort of like en passant, is that as a stock picker, you have the advantage of being able to stock pick, right? And not all the commodity names are the same.
Right.
You have some of these guys that have huge free cash flow and they're investing well, and I think the market will reward those, even though maybe as a whole, like if you look at the XLE or XOP, are much harder to trade. But there are some individual names that will get rewarded, because one of the biggest fears of the commodity investor, and I tell you that from experience, is that these guys are crazy, right? These guys will make money. No, I mean, these guys will have a huge cash flows, and then they will just like burn it on stuff, right? And they will waste it completely. And that's the default mentality of the commodity investor. Okay, you're making money, but unless you're giving it to me, I don't believe you, right? So this free cash flow may look good. I mean, I've been through these motions, and then they basically waste it, right? So unless they're paying it out and giving it to investors, it's hard to attach a lot of value, except to those guys that are demonstrating that they're using it wisely. And I think that commodity investors will love that. And I think that we're seeing that. So you can find those names. I don't follow it closely enough these days to tell you who those are. But I know that when you find a management team that is using capital wisely, they will get rewarded. And then the rest will be, okay, I'm not sure what you're going to do with this, because there are so many cowboys in an industry.
Yeah, yeah. All right, fellas. Well, you know what? Honestly, unless you guys, any closing thoughts, Marcos, of what you think we should be looking at, especially me on my side of it, or any other things to note that we didn't cover?
I think the best way right now in August, liquidity is being very thin. There is going to be opportunity to pick some names out when somebody panics, or again, the market is a crazy dude. So from here till year end, I'm sure that there will be moments where you say, oh, I wanted to buy this, but I can buy now 20% lower than I could in August. And I think that's the thing that you want to be doing now. Just be patient. Don't FOMO it into it.
Yeah.
I would say.
Yeah.
You have the algo to do that.
Yes. Yeah. No. And boy, don't I love having it. Chase, any thoughts or any things that you wanted to hit that we didn't go over?
Just make a budget for some higher volatility, and as long as the fundamental driving forces behind some of these trades hasn't changed, then just stay strong. And you know me, I've been preaching this cold winter thing for a long time, and I think that's going to create a disorderly spike in gas and coal, and it won't feel good to sell into that, but it'll probably be time to sell a good bit of that this winter, if I'm right and we get that spike.
Yeah, no, well, it's like I was telling you the other day, I'm kind of sitting on the opposite end of the spectrum. It feels hard to hold those names right now just because we've made so much money on them. Yes. And then you just go back to the fundamentals, and I'm sitting there going, I can't bring myself to sell this thing. It is still so bloody cheap. But we're managing the risk. I'm not going to sit there and give it back. But good Lord, it's just
I fight the urge to sell Nat Gas stuff every day. That's the one. I mean, it's just going straight up, and I just want to sell it every single day. And I don't even know how I've managed to not do a lot of selling.
Yeah, no, it's difficult. Well, anyway, guys, I really, as always, really appreciate it and appreciate the insights. And I thought this was fun. Hopefully, some people can get some thoughts out of it. I know that I did, and you guys have kind of re-cemented that approach that we've been taking, and I think that's the way that we're going to I know that's the way we're going to proceed through the end of the year as of now, until things change. And as always, fellas, when you see those things change, I'm obviously relying on you to pound the table and sound the alarm and get my attention.
Sounds great. I enjoyed it.
Absolutely. All right, fellas, thank you so much for joining us today, and as always, we will be back next week. I don't know if we're going to have another deep dive segment next week. I'm still trying to reschedule the gentleman that I had to cancel with because of the death in the family. We're either going to get him on next week or the week after that, and that'll be the next deep dive segment. But hope you guys enjoyed it. Thank you so much. And as always, you're listening to the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.